Welcome to another Network Twat. My name is Luminaire, and today I'm going to be covering some of the more interesting features of LANs. I received a lot of good feedback about my first Twat, and I'm glad that people have found this content interesting. I'd like to thank the people who gave me constructive criticism about what I need to add to the episode in order to make it more informative. Some of the material that I've gone over so far is a little in-depth, even if it sounds easy. One problem that I have is I tend to think that many people already have a strong foundation in the material, or that they'll be able to pick it up after hearing it once. Unfortunately, the concepts that I'm talking about can be difficult to learn, so if you do have any questions or need clarification, and you can't find any resources that accurately describe it on the web, feel free to email me, and I'll do my best to explain it to you. Before I launch into the main topic, I want to take a quick second to explain a useful but very controversial component of basic networking. Whenever you open a networking textbook or take a networking course, one of the first things that you are taught is the OSI 7-layer network. Anyone who was in the Pound BinRev channel when my last episode came out may have heard people complaining about me referring to the OSI 7-layer model. The reason for this is that the OSI 7-layer model is not very relevant to actual networking. For example, while the first four layers make sense, layer 5 starts to get a little blurry, as does layer 6. With these two layers, it seems that the technologies have been forced to fit awkwardly into places that they don't belong. Perhaps a better layering scheme is the TCP network model. The TCP model's layers are network, internetwork, transport, and application. Network is your data link layer. Internetwork is your network layer. Transportation's definition remains the same, and the application layer remains the same. With this model, we are no longer concerned with the physical layer, as almost all network protocols are independent of the physical layer. We also cut out the session and presentation layers, which are largely useless in a network model. The OSI 7-layer model only provides for a simple way to refer to network protocols and technologies, however, it does a poor job of doing so. Unfortunately, it's a terminology that we cannot escape from, as marketeers love branding products Layer 3 devices or Layer 2 devices. For the time being, at least, it is important to know the OSI 7-layer network model and how relevant technologies fit into the model, and also the various terms for describing communications at different levels. For example, we've all heard people talk about packets. The term packet just refers to a layer 3, that is a network layer, transmission. A simple way of describing any transmission is a protocol data unit. A packet would be a layer 3 protocol data unit, or a layer 3 PDU. A segment is a layer 4 or transport layer PDU, so a section of a TCP transmission is a TCP segment. Layer 2 transmissions are referred to as frames. Now the next time you hear someone talk about an Ethernet packet, you can have a little laugh at them. That's not to say that there is a right way and a wrong way to say everything. You'll find that the more you learn, the more you'll find that different sources contradict each other. The worst part is that if you try to stick with the standards, you'll often get the short end of the stick, as standards are often overly complex and for the most part a waste of time. Try and stick with a constant terminology that is widely accepted and most importantly makes sense to you. No one will ever be confused if you refer to Ethernet frames, IP packets, or TCP segments, but there are contradictions to every rule. I'll do my best to stick to widely accepted terms. If anyone disagrees, please feel free to email me and I'll take it into consideration. I don't want to argue semantics, I just want to provide the best information possible. Today I'll be covering VLANs, or virtual LANs. VLANs are a feature that is implemented on almost all Layer 2 and Layer 3, also known as multi-layer switches, and are a great tool for any network engineer. Although there have been many advances to this technology made by vendors, I'll only be covering standardized technology. Although the networking world is dominated by Cisco, it's important to focus on the open alternative, as well as open standards encourage community learning, and the improvement of technology, whereas closed standards encourage profit margins and vendor lock-in. Consider the recent case where Cisco used its patents to suppress an open implementation of VRRP, which is itself an open standard. Although this has led to the development of a superior protocol, that is, CARP, it is important to note that it is the prerogative of the companies to encourage their profit margins to rise first, and second, to encourage innovation and improvement of technology. I don't mean to turn this into Cisco bashing, as they make many fine products and are true innovators in the field, but it is important to focus on open standards and not just hone your skills on proprietary technology. And now, without further ado, I shall begin. Just to review the relevant concepts from my last episode, I'd like to go over the concept of a collision domain again. A collision domain is any segment or portion of a network where if two devices were to transmit at the same time, a collision would occur. Original implementations of Ethernet had every device connected to the same wire using a series of taps. As you can imagine, if host A is transmitting on the wire, host B can't begin transmitting, or it will drown out host A. It's the same thing as if you're standing with a bunch of friends at a party. If your friend is talking, and you attempt to talk at the same time, your friend won't be able to make sense of either conversation. For this reason, if host A wants to transmit, it will first listen on the wire to see if it's busy. If it isn't, host A will start to transmit. CSMACD prevents collisions that would occur if two hosts start talking at the exact same time. A broadcast domain, on the other hand, is a logical section of the network where any computer connected can directly transmit to any other computer without using a router. It is the area of a network where a broadcast from one PC will be received by all others in that broadcast domain. It's hard to understand broadcast domains without understanding subnetting and subnet masks. However, that is a concept that is impossible to teach without graphs, and since this is an internet radio show, I'll have to leave that up to you guys to learn by yourselves. For broadcast, the important thing to know is that broadcast from one host is received by all other hosts on the network, or in that broadcast domain. The hosts have to process the broadcast, which consumes resources, and there are far too many protocols that rely on broadcast to get their work done. In short, too many broadcasts are a bad thing. VLANs are a logical way of segmenting broadcast domains. Consider the case where a VLAN is not used on a 48-port switch. If 48 computers are connected to the switch, then a broadcast from any one of those computers will be received by all 47 other computers. Depending on the protocols that are being used, this can consume network resources, as well as host resources, as broadcasts need to be passed up the protocol stack, which will consume CPU resources at the very least. If VLANs were used, the network engineer could segment the switch into two broadcast domains. Ports 1 to 24 would be in one broadcast domain, and ports 25 to 48 would be in a second broadcast domain. A broadcast from a machine in VLAN 1 would not be heard in VLAN 2. The effect of this would be the same as using two 24-port switches. There are several reasons for using VLANs. Firstly, IP broadcast traffic consumes resources, as mentioned previously. Normally, in a switch network, the only packets that an end device should have to process are packets that are addressed to it, broadcast packets, and frames that are flooded in a network. The NIC will examine the MAC address and compare it to its own to decide whether to accept the frame. Based on this criteria, the switch will either pass it up the stack or discard it. If an end device has to process too many packets, its CPU load will be increased needlessly. VLANs can be used to group hosts together, either based on broadcast protocols that they will need to receive, groups or numbers of hosts, or any number of other reasons. The second reason to use VLANs is buggy or misconfigured protocols can initiate broadcast storms, which can cause a network to grind to a halt. Broadcast storms occur when misconfigured hosts start to create broadcast traffic, which in turn creates further broadcast traffic. This broadcast traffic can slow an entire network, and since broadcast traffic must be processed by every host on a network, it can also cause the computers on the network to slow down significantly. This is not so much an issue when using modern networking equipment, as many managed switches which support VLANs also support broadcast storm control. Thirdly, broadcast traffic, such as ARP, rises in proportion to the number of hosts on the network. VLANs can be used to keep the amount of ARP and other network management traffic low by ensuring that, for example, no more than 24 hosts are connected in the same broadcast domain. Once again, this example is overly exaggerated, but you get the point. From a security standpoint, users can only sniff traffic in their own VLANs. In a switch network, end devices should only be receiving traffic that is either addressed to them, flooded due to incomplete MAC tables on a switch, or broadcasted. However, as we are well aware, switches and end devices can be tricked into transmitting to an attacker. VLANs can be used to greatly improve the security of a network, for example, by grouping all accountants together in one VLAN, and grouping the other staff in a second VLAN. Staff in VLAN 2 will not be able to intercept the accountant's traffic by using ARP spoofing techniques. There are other ways to mitigate ARP spoofing attacks, however, this is one of the easier to configure and maintain. Finally, from a network design point of view, VLANs allow for flexible network configurations. For example, as described above, departments can be grouped together regardless of where on a network they are, which brings me to another important point. Protocols exist, both proprietary in the case of ISL and open in the case of 802.1Q, to extend VLANs across multiple switches. This would allow you to have one accountant network that extends across any number of switches. If you have two offices containing accountants at opposite ends of the building, with users connected to two different switches and other departments connected to each switch, it is possible to have the accountant VLAN on both switches. Logically speaking, that is, from the point of view of a higher layer protocol, the accountants are connected to one switch. As you can see, this adds much flexibility when designing a network. However, also be wary, as having VLANs extend across multiple switches also extends broadcast traffic across multiple switches. If every switch has at least one member from every VLAN, from a bandwidth and resource point of view, it would be better to have them all connected under one VLAN. The only aspect that is not mitigated by this configuration is security. In general, there are two types of VLANs, tagged VLANs and untagged VLANs. This does not refer to frames or packets while they are crossing the switch's backplane, as that information can only be used internally to a switch and is of no use to end nodes or other devices on a network. These terms refer to Ethernet frames that are in transit across a network. An untagged frame is an Ethernet frame that contains no VLAN information. As end stations require either special software or many times special hardware to process VLAN tags, it should always be assumed that when passing frames to an end device such as a PC, the frame should be untagged. This means stripping or removing the tags from the frame. The second type is a tagged frame. This means that VLAN information has been added to the frame. As mentioned above, normally special software is required, such as VLAN devices on OpenBSD or special NICs that can process 802.1Q. More on this later. In terms of networking equipment and actual implementations, there is really only one dominant implementation of each type of VLAN. Port-based VLANs are VLANs that are assigned to a certain port on a switch. There is no modification made to the Ethernet frame to indicate which VLAN it originated from. The switch records which ports are members of which VLANs and tags the frames internally as they cross the switch's backplanes. As the frames are passed out of the switch, the VLAN information is stripped. For networks containing only one switch, or VLANs that don't migrate through the network, port-based VLANs are easy to configure. However, they don't scale well to larger configurations. Overlapping VLANs, that is, a port that is a member of multiple VLANs without using any sort of tagging information, were not possible up until recently. 802.1Q is a VLAN tagging protocol that was standard by the IEEE for passing VLAN information between switches and allowing end devices to be aware of VLAN information. 802.1Q adds two pieces of information to the Ethernet header. Firstly, a tag is added to the Ethernet header to indicate the VLAN that the frame originated from. Secondly, a priority field was added. This field is used for 802.1p QoS, but that is not relevant to today's discussion. 802.1q adds several interesting features to VLANs. Firstly, with 802.1q, it is possible for an end station, such as a mail server, or any other infrastructure server to be a member of multiple VLANs and receive and send packets with multiple VLAN tags. Using my previous example with the accounting department, if there was an infrastructure server such as a database server that needed to be accessible by both the accountants in VLAN 1 and the other users in VLAN 2, the database server could be configured to be a member of both VLAN 1 and 2 by using 802.1q. Details of how to configure this vary based upon the operating system used. However, with BSD, it involves creating a VLAN interface for every tagged VLAN that the device is a member of. Although this is also possible with port-based VLANs, using asymmetric VLANs, those VLANs work more like Layer 2 firewalls, commonly known as ACLs, rather than VLANs, and that information cannot be passed between switches. Another feature that 802.1q adds to the concept of VLANs is the ability to extend VLAN information across multiple switches. As the frames are tagged with VLAN information, links between switches can be made members of every VLAN and thus turned into trunk ports, which is more of a Cisco concept. Using VLAN trunks, if a member of VLAN 1 is connected to a different switch than the other members of VLAN 1, it will be possible for that member to communicate with the rest of their department. This is because the switch can update its MAC tables to reflect the member of VLAN 1 on both switches. In order to communicate between VLANs, packets must be routed. I will first provide a gentle intro to IP-based routing. We've all seen IP routing, even if at the time we weren't aware of what we were watching. IP routing involves moving IP packets between different networks. A simple example of this is two networks, 192.168.0.0/24 and 10.0.0.0/24 connected to a router. If a device in the 192.168.0 network wants to communicate with a device in the second network, its traffic must be routed. In order to fully understand routing, though, we must take a look at how routing decisions are determined. As I was explaining the network scheme earlier, you may have been wondering what the /24 represented. That number represents the subnet mask of the IP address, and allows devices to easily determine whether or not they are in the same network as a target destination. In this example, the device in the 192.168.0 network will take the network portion of the 10.0.0 destination address, in this case 10.0.0, and compare it with the network portion of its own IP address, which is 192.168.0. If you don't really understand where these numbers are derived from, there are many good resources on subnetting available online. However, that is not a topic for today's episode. If the network portions are not the same, which in this case they're not, a routing table lookup is performed. As a basic rule of thumb, end devices should never make routing decisions, other than to forward packets that are to be routed to their default gateway. That is what occurs in this case. The host in the 192.168.0 network forwards the packet to the router, which in turn then looks up a route in its own routing table, and forwards it onto the second network. That is the essence of IP routing. Now, many of you will be asking what this has to do with VLANs. Well, to truly benefit from all that is to be had from VLANs, you should route traffic between them. This also means that each VLAN has to be in a different network, and have a router port be a member of each VLAN. An important thing to note at this point is that broadcast packets will never be routed. The same way that switches break up collision domains, routers break up broadcast domains. When a unicast packet, which is a packet with only one destination, needs to travel between VLANs, it will be forwarded to its router. The router then decides, based on its routing table, where to send the packet. In order to properly communicate between VLANs, the router must have an interface in each VLAN, or have a router in each VLAN. If you are directly connecting a router to each VLAN, then it is important to consider where you are going to position the router in the VLAN. It is of interest to note how routers can be made members of VLANs, and will now give a couple good examples about where to place a router in a VLAN. Believe it or not, this is not as easy as it seems. Example A. The simplest way to place a router in a VLAN is to have every VLAN be a member of a different network range that adheres to classful IP ranges, such as 192.168.0.0 for VLAN 1, 192.168.1.0 for VLAN 2, and so on. In order to connect the two networks, you would connect an interface on your router to each VLAN and give its interfaces IP addresses in each subnet. As the router is connected to each network, it can now route between VLANs as packets require. Example B. The above example got the job done, but it also consumed multiple switch ports. If you only want one switch port to be used by your router, you can easily use 802.1q to make your router a member of multiple VLANs. Depending on what platform you are using for routers, this will be configured in multiple ways. On Layer 3 switches, VLANs or IP interfaces normally need to be created, giving the router one physical interface with multiple IPs and VLAN tags. With other platforms, VLAN interfaces are created, however the effect is the same. One physical interface with multiple VLAN tags and IP addresses. Keep in mind that when this type of configuration is used, the switches must be configured to leave VLAN tags intact when forwarding to the router. This means that 802.1Q must be used in this case. TWAD is community radio, released by the community for the community, with a little help from Droops and Petrillo. If you have a tech topic that you would like to speak about, contact Droops or Petrillo through the Infonomicon channel on irc.freenode.net, that's #Infonomicon. You can also obtain their contact information through www.infonomicon.org. For more information, check out the FAQ at www.twatech.org. And while you're there, check out some of the other interesting and informative episodes. If you have any questions or comments about today's show, please contact me at salvea@gmail.com. That's salvea@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and this has been another Network Twat.